The Catholic Channel Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, we talk about big items here on the Just Love on the Catholic Channel. And today's one of them. We're going to speak about the canonization of Pope Paul VI and Archbishop Romero. And we're going to speak about that. And we have as our guest Father Hernan Paredes, who is a pastor in the Archdiocese of New York and who is heading to Rome. And he stopped by in the studio here on his way to the airport. So we're delighted to do that. So that's kind of a big topic. And then a little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak with Chrisaine Villacourt Murphy. We're going to speak with her by telephone, and we're going to speak with her about the death penalty and some of the changes that's been going on there. She's part of the Catholic Mobilizing Network. But, you know, we talk about those big, big items. And sometimes in a chaotic world that we live in, we say, well, what do we do? What can we do to make our world just, etc.? And that's why, kind of, I say all the time, well, if you love God and if you love your neighbor, and if you love yourself, if you do that, then our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. So, you know, we don't have to solve the big problems of the world individually. We got to pay attention to them, but they are things that each of us can do in order to make our world a better place. And, you know, when sometimes the big things seem out of control, it's worthwhile that we focus on the little things. So, Fanny, what do you think? You like the fact that that fall is coming up? You were complaining about the weather. I mean, isn't the weather just nice these days?
Today.
Right.
It's nice. I mean, I think this whole week it's going to be pretty nice. I believe it's raining maybe Sunday. I'm not sure, but I'm okay with it this week.
Okay.
Maybe it'll get cold and then I won't like it.
You know, we also got to say a prayer because, you know, hurricanes are coming again and
yep.
People in Florida. And so, you know, the damage that is done there. And somebody described to me kind of one of the ways you can think of a hurricane sometimes. And when they're slow moving, like they sit over a place for a while
right.
And they just soak the place. So somebody said, like, you know, you think about a typhoon, like it comes through in maybe 15, 30 seconds. He said, like, sometimes with that rain, it makes it seem like it stays there for, you know, a half hour or so. And it's like really completely out of control. So we got to keep those people who are impacted by the weather in our prayers and in our thoughts. But, you know, I'm anxious to speak with Father Hernan Paredes, who is a Jesuit priest. He's now here in New York. He's the pastor of Our Lady of Mount Carmel Parish on Staten Island. And he's going over to Rome, and he's going over to Rome to be part of the ceremony in which Archbishop Oscar Romero, who is being canonized as a pope. Father Hernan, thanks for joining us here in the studio at Just Love. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Monsignor. My pleasure to be here and my joy to be part of this great event for the Catholic Church all over the world, not only for the Americas, but for the whole church, that we need the hope, we need the strength of our saints, people whom gave their lives for Christ, people who loved one another, like Bishop Romero, as you said at the very beginning. Bishop Romero was able to love, and he even died out of love for his people. And all the time he was even telling at the end of his life that he will forgive even those who will kill him, because he was he had threats many times, people telling that they were going to kill him if he didn't stop talking, in being the voice of the powerless, the voice of the voiceless. So it's a great pleasure for me to be in Rome in this time with the people of God, rejoicing on the holiness of Bishop Romero.
So, Father Hema, let's give our listeners a little bit of a sense of Archbishop Romero. We're going back now probably, maybe over 30 years, right, to 1980
yes.
is when he was actually martyred in El Salvador. But describe for our listeners, you know, what was the situation in El Salvador when Archbishop Romero was the Archbishop of El Salvador?
Yes, it was a very difficult situation in the country. You have to remember that most of the countries in South and Central America at that time, the 70s, 80s, they have a military government. And in the case in El Salvador, they were very oppressive of the people. They were killing people, innocent people, and they were protecting the rich and powerful. In El Salvador, in the time that we are talking about, there were only 14 families who were all owners of the whole country. Can you imagine 14 families which have everything and the rest nothing? In that context comes the figure of Bishop Romero, who at the beginning he was a traditional bishop, if you wish. He was a scholar, we will call here in the United States. He loved the church, he loved studies, but not much being in contact with the people. The moment that the shocking moment for him and that many of his biographers will call his conversion was the time when a Jesuit, Father Rutilio Grande, that probably will become a blessed, he's in his way to be beatified, hopefully sooner than later. He was murdered by the government, and in that context where the other key figure in that context of the rich, the powerful government, of military government, were the guerrilla. So they were in conflict, they were trying to take over the government, and they couldn't. So it was, and they were killing people as well. So if it's the poor suffer both sides. If they help the guerrilla, they were killed by the government. If they help the government, they were a hostage of the guerrilla. So, and in that context, Romero said, stop the violence. Stop the violence that comes from anywhere. And we have to find another way to give peace to these people.
We're speaking with Father Hernan Paredes, who is a Jesuit priest. He is the pastor of a parish in Staten Island, but he was born in Ecuador. And because of the connection of his fellow Jesuits in El Salvador, has became very familiar with the situation in El Salvador. So I guess if I could summarize for our listeners what you said, that if you go back, you know, into the 1970s and 80s, the situation in certain countries, and El Salvador being one of them, that there was a really strong concentration of wealth in very, very few people, which wasn't shared. And there was a lot of poverty in the country, too. And if we set like a little bit of the political environment, you kind of had a military there that tried to keep order, keep the people who had the power, who had the wealth in their position. And then you had people who were kind of opposition to that. We would call them guerrilla warfares, who were trying to take over. They were trying to unturn that situation where a few people had all the money and a lot of people had none of the money. And so you had a real conflictual situation. And I think what you describe is that in that situation, ordinary people, they get caught in the middle.
Yes.
They get caught in the middle. And
yes,
sometimes they're even used by one side or the other to kind of further their political agenda. In doing that. And so it's interesting because I think what you described of Archbishop Romero is, to some extent, he kind of was, I don't want to say a simple priest, but he was, you know, had a very kind of traditional. Did he teach in the seminary, actually?
I think so. He was the rector in the seminary as well in El Salvador, at that time, the only seminary for in El Salvador.
Right. And then he was made the Archbishop of El Salvador, and maybe we might be say his eyes were opened, especially when somebody close to him was killed by the violence that was there. So then how did he himself die? I mean, he received threats. How did he die?
Yes, he received many threats. And he acknowledged that his voice, he loved to talk and record. He had all his homilies, or if not all, most of them were broadcast every week. So he was a man ahead of the time, if you wish, in a poor country speaking. And everybody was able to listen to him. And he was calling, stop the fighting, and be brothers, don't kill your brothers. He said literally that. So he was celebrating Mass in the 24th of March 1980 at they call the El Hospitalito, in a place in a chapel. And at the moment that he was presiding over the Mass, he just finished his homily, a gunman came from the behind and killed him, and he was shot and died immediately.
Wow. Did they capture the gunman?
Unfortunately, no. From the very beginning, it was denying that they were trying to blame the guerrilla first, the political context. But later on, everybody know that the disgrace, Dawinson, I believe is the colonel, a military, high powerful military, he is the one who ordered the murder of Romero.
Wow. And I guess because he was just speaking the gospel and telling people not to be violent, telling people not to kill, and that was too much of a threat to the people who were there. Because I guess, you know, he probably didn't say, well, it's okay for the military to kill, but it's not okay for the guerrillas to kill. Or he didn't say it was okay for the guerrillas to kill and not the military. He probably just said nobody should be killing each other. And that kind of hurt the people who were in power.
Yes, he said, stop the violence. And he ordered, that you should stop killing one another. And that was the day before he actually was killed. Yeah. So
we're speaking with Father Germán Paredes, a Jesuit priest who is a pastor of parish in New York, but has had a lot of contact with El Salvador. He was born in Ecuador. Now, could you speak just a little bit about the work of the Jesuits in El Salvador? What type of ministries were they engaged in that country?
Most of the time, the Jesuits were known all over the world to be teaching. And we had in El Salvador, still we do have the Catholic University, UCA. And 7 years later than Bishop Romero, six Jesuits the head of the university, Ignacio Leacuría, and five other Jesuits were killed. So, and most of the time, the Jesuits in El Salvador, they had high schools the best university, I believe, is still in El Salvador. But Rutilio Grande was the Jesuit who was killed and a friend of Bishop Romero. He was sent, after he was teaching in the seminary, he was sent to become a pastor. That was something new in the 70s. Again, the Jesuit wanted to be with the people and because of their involvement with the people, the he suffered death as well. So, but the Jesuits, they are still doing a great work in the university, in high school administration, and as well a few parishes in El Salvador, in the countryside.
Now, but they, at times, and when a situation is chaotic, sometimes people are engaged with the community, they're going out with the community, and sometimes people kind of make claims about them and others. Some people were saying, well, the Jesuits weren't doing what they were supposed to do because they were fighting the government. And I think the Jesuits said, no, we're working with the poor. There was a little bit of controversy, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was a lot of controversy. Even the because of that controversy, that some of the people didn't like the friendship of Bishop Romero with the Jesuits. They thought the Jesuits changed Romero. Of course, for the rich and powerful, or for the government, the Jesuits were the ones who were the leaders or the of the guerrilla. The Jesuits were the ones who were talking about overthrowing the establishment. But the Jesuits, the only thing that they were saying, like Bishop Romero, were trying to be the voice of the voiceless.
Right. So. Yeah. So Father Hernan, okay, you're going over to Rome, but we're going to share with our listeners a little bit more, and we want the inside story. We want the dope, because you studied to become a Jesuit, and didn't you get some training, not in Ecuador, but didn't you go down to Argentina?
Yes, I did, and I was young and naive. I was only 21 or 22 years
old.
Yeah,
but you had kind of a spiritual director and a teacher and a rector there who kind of has made a new name for himself, hasn't he? Who was your spiritual director and the rector down there?
Well, I call him Jorge Mario Bergoglio, that everybody call him Pope Francis, but not me.
So you knew him when?
Yes, 35 years ago, we have been friends. Well, first he was my superior. He was always the man that you know. That's the man that has been always, especially to the friends. He's always a welcoming a friend, that he will embrace you, he will teach you, he will know about your family, at that time, to myself, or being Ecuadorian Jesuit, going to Argentina, and that your rector, your superior, the rector of the seminary, is cooking for you,
cooked? He cooked?
Yes, every other week.
Was he any good?
He was the best.
The best cook?
Yes. Ah. Italian food. I have to say that since that time, I have been always eating Italian food because of him.
Well, now he's like a combination. Some of his relatives were Italian and others were Argentinian?
Yeah, he's first generation Argentinian. Yeah.
So was he a nice guy or not? What do you,
he
nice
is,
guy?
He's very nice, he's very, very nice. I will be, as a matter of fact, I will be with him in 2 days. I will be at St. Martha, the place that he lives, and we'll celebrate the Mass at 7 o'clock. And I will post a picture afterwards.
And will he make pasta for you, you think?
Well, not now. He has a lot of things, and he has an Argentinian nun that cooks for him, so that he puts a little weight.
Now somebody told me, I don't know where I read it, that they told him he's eating too much pasta and he's getting a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yes. I know that because I get too fat, so I understand. But you know, to some extent, wasn't there a little bit like Archbishop Romero a little bit? Wasn't he perceived, like when he was the head of the Jesuits there, to be kind of a little bit rigid and a little bit traditional in his approach to some of that? Am I recalling correctly or not?
Yes, you are right. And because of that, not many Jesuits from other countries or other provinces, we call, went to study in Buenos Aires. But in my province, we needed, he offered the scholarships and we were able to be there. So, and it was good for him because he was able to say, look, other provinces trust on me and I am doing this job for.
So since you've known him for all these years and you've kept in contact, were you surprised when he was elected Pope?
Yes and no. When Pope Benedict was elected, I thought at that time, and I even wrote something, so I have it written down, that I thought that my friend will become the Pope. But last time, I thought he was too old, but and I was with him 5 months before he was elected, and we had a long conversation. And he was only waiting. I said, "What is next?" I said in that in Spanish, "¿Qué es lo siguiente?" What is next? And he said, "Well, I am I already resigned, and I am waiting the Holy Father to send a new man to the post." Mm. But he didn't know that he will become the new Pope.
So now we know, Father Hernan, we know that there is no politics in the church, okay? There's no but can we say that you were plotting and you were running his campaign to become Pope? Is that?
Well, in Long Island, yes.
But, you know, again, everything is supposed to be secret there, and I don't know, but I've heard a rumor, which I don't know if this is true, but that when Pope Benedict was elected, that that Cardinal Bergoglio came in second.
Yes.
Now, I don't know how people know that, but that's what I heard.
Well, that was I believe it was an article in the New York Times about the Cardinal wrote some notes and left in a hotel.
Ah.
So that is the way. And supposedly the cardinals are not to give any notes because of the conclave. But it that was the way that some people knew about that. But
So the one thing I'll share with you, and we've shared it with our listeners, but I'll share it again, that when Pope Francis came to New York probably 3 years ago, we were privileged at Catholic Charities to organize a meeting with about 150 immigrants and refugees from probably 20 different countries so he could meet them. And we met in a parish gym up in East Harlem, and it was a wonderful, kind of wonderful event. And I had the opportunity to welcome him for the group. And the whole event was done in Spanish. And so as he was leaving, I said to him, and I'll do it. You'll understand in Spanish, then Fanny, then you translate it for our listeners, okay? I said, Santo Padre, perdóname porque mi español no es tan bueno porque yo lo aprendí in Colombia, no in Argentina. So say that.
You apologized and you said, Holy Father, forgive me, my Spanish isn't very good because I learned it in Colombia and not in Argentina.
And he said to me, sí, pero los colombianos tienen mejor café.
That's true. He said, yes, but the Colombians have better coffee.
Yes, that's right. Always a joke.
So anyway, so listen, you have our best wishes on your trip to Rome for the canonization of Archbishop Romero and Pope Paul VI and four other people. And I am delighted that you're going to get to see your friend. And at least one of you made good in the world, didn't you? And thank you so much for your ministry here in the Archdiocese of New York and on Staten Island. Thank you for all you're doing. And as we talked about a little bit before, we are delighted that one of your fellow countrymen, Father Esteban Sanchez, is ministering in a parish in Westchester, and he was a guest on the show, sitting right in the same chair that you.
So you see, the Ecuadorians are taking over.
Well, I will tell you, we would be a much better world if you and Father Sanchez were in charge of it. I would pledge my allegiance to you being in charge.
Thank you so much, Monsignor. My pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us on Just Love. You know what, Fanny? I think we'll take a break. As we say, just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is the Catholic Channel. Join us when we come back just a moment. This is Just Love. And this is Sirius 129.
Now, let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love yourself. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. So we just had a delightful conversation with Father Hernan Paredes, who is a friend of Pope Francis. And when Pope Francis was Father Bergoglio down in Argentina, Father Hernan went and was in the Jesuit novitiate there and kind of knew him as the rector, the pastor, the spiritual director there. And he's going over to Rome to kind of check out the canonization of Archbishop Romero and Pope Paul VI. So Fanny, you don't even know there's a Pope Paul VI, do you?
No. Well, I mean, yes, if I Google it.
Right. But he was, because the only Pope that you really knew was John Paul II until we got Pope Benedict and now Pope Francis.
Right.
So here's a little trivia question.
Mm-hmm.
Why is Pope John Paul II called Pope John Paul II?
Well, I'm guessing there was a John Paul the First.
You got it.
JP1?
Yeah, JP1. JP1. And when do you think he was Pope?
I mean, I'm guessing before JP2. I just don't know the
year. How long? How long before?
Well, what you just told me?
You can
which
say
Which was,
that. Yeah.
30, would you say 32 days?
Well, no, he was Pope immediately before, but he was only Pope for a month.
Right.
He was only Pope for
Which
a month.
I was mind blown because I had no idea.
Yep. And boy, when he died, all of the rumors and speculations and conspiracy theories about how he was poisoned, what happened to him, and you know, but they were all over the place. Yeah. But it seems like, you know, he just died.
Was he very old?
No, he wasn't that old. But you know what? A lot of people speculated. He smiled all the time, and some people actually speculated that he smiled too much, and that's why they got rid of him.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was like really, really a little bit crazy.
Funny.
But here's something which is a little bit interesting, a little bit historical. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we talked about Archbishop Romero being canonized a saint. Okay, but you know who else is going to be canonized a saint this weekend? Is Pope Paul VI.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, this is really a real history lesson. Hey, Tom, so who was the Pope before Pope Paul VI?
I'm going to say John the 23rd.
Right. John the 23rd, okay? And if you do a little bit of the history stuff, okay?
Mm-hmm.
John the 23rd was supposed to be a lame duck, okay? Cuz he was elderly when they appointed him and they kind of needed a caretaker to be pope. But he was not a caretaker. So he was the one who kind of said, we're going to have a new council, we're going to look at things, we're going to open the windows of the church, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he was there. Then you had Paul the VI, who was a little bit more quiet, a little bit more scholarly, not as outgoing, not as whatever. My own judgment, I think kind of Paul the VI was really, really good and really important in a lot of ways. And I think just because he wasn't as outwardly as, quote unquote, jolly as John the 23rd, he got, you know, a reputation for being a little bit of a stick in the mud, which, you know, and a couple of other reasons, which I won't go into right now. But when the next pope came along after him, he wanted to communicate to people that you couldn't say John the 23rd was the good guy, Paul the VI was the stick in the mud, etc. So that's why he took a name that combined both their names, John and Paul. So he took John Paul, and that's how you got it. And when the next pope came along, who lasted more like 32 years rather than
32 days.
He just wanted to symbolize kind of continuity. So I think, at least that's what I think he took, John Paul II. So anyway, so that's what's happening this weekend in Rome. So Fanny, there's news again about the Met Gala?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there'll be news every year.
Okay.
We'll try to update our listeners every year if
okay,
they care.
Okay, so what's happening? What's happening next year?
So this year was the Catholic theme.
Right.
Right? That everyone remembers.
Heavenly bodies.
Heavenly bodies, yes. And this year's theme, which I was a little bit confused about, I had to do my research. So the theme for this 2019 Met Gala would be Camp, Notes on Fashion. The entitled Camp Notes on Fashion, the 2019 show, looks likely to be the most outrageous to date, with the theme drawing in a 1964 Susan Sontag essay that describes camp as love of the unnatural, the artifice and exaggeration. So I had to research this because when I thought camp, I thought tent. Right?
Okay.
that's what I thought. But it's not. It's this very elaborate, eccentric, crazy runway look.
Right.
Very colorful, there's no real silhouette to a dress, nothing like that at all. Another thing about this kind of genre of fashion is that it can be anything. So it can be like political camp, it can be religious camp, it can be literally anything. So there's going to be a lot of diversity in how we see these celebrities dressed next year.
So you going?
I'm gonna go. Just kidding. I'm not going. I'll watch from home.
You're going to watch from home?
Yeah.
All right. So 1 year I want to go, okay? I'm going to put that on my bucket
list. We should see how we can get in.
Yeah.
Even if we sneak in.
Okay. I think we want to put that on our bucket list.
Okay.
So, Fanny, there's kind of, there's some more not so good news about immigrants. So what's that new news?
Yeah. So the Trump administration's proposal to make it more difficult for people to legally come to the U.S. or stay here could keep apart hundreds of and thousands of married couples who don't earn enough money. So the administration wants to create an income test for people wanting to legally enter the U.S. or become legal residents. The test would generally give high marks to people with households income of more than 250% of poverty, about $41,000 for two people, $62,000 for a family of four. The proposal sets a minimum income of 125% of poverty, over $20,000 for a household of two, and over $31,000 for four, for consideration of whether they could become dependent on public benefits. But the rule considers household earnings of at least 250% of poverty to be a highly weighed positive factor. It's not a bright line. If you have an income of above 250% of poverty level, you are not assured that there won't be a denial, but you are in much better shape, says Mark Greenberg, a senior fellow at the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute think tank.
So, we talked about this a little bit. We probably talked about this before. But this is one of those situations where kind of there's not a bright line, as you said, Fanny. But, currently that we expect immigrants coming here that they're going to come, they're going to get a job, they're with relatives, they're not going to go on public assistance, that they're going to be industrious. And they are, overwhelmingly. What this does is say, hey, wait a minute. We used to say you can't go on cash assistance, but now there are a lot of other ways of doing it, and giving extra points if you have more money. And again, some of this is not absolute. So there was always, I'm going to get this wrong, but I'll be generally right. There was always kind of like a millionaire's visa, that if you could kind of invest a lot of money in a company, and if you could maybe grow 10 jobs or something like that, you could get a special business visa. I'm not quite sure. Don't hold me to that, listeners, but it's in that ballpark. And so now they're kind of playing with some of that stuff to broaden it and yet narrow it for particular types of people who are coming in. And that's a little bit, at least from our Catholic perspective, we got to be very cautious about that, because that's a very, very dangerous kind of situation. And so it's something that we need to monitor. So anyway, so Fanny, tell us, the other thing I want to know is tell us about what Taylor Swift's up to.
Yeah, so the American Music Awards aired on Tuesday night. And she is actually, I haven't heard from her in a while, so I thought she was kind of either making an album or whatever, but apparently I was very wrong, and
I thought you went out for drinks the other night.
I know. I guess I'm not the biggest fan in the world.
Okay.
Like, I'm very disappointed in myself. But anyway, so Taylor Swift became the most decorated female artist in AMA history with 23 total awards on Tuesday night. She also encouraged viewers to go out and vote on November 5th, a message that was spread throughout the entire show, because several celebrities delivered the same message to viewers. Vote.org said it saw a $65,000 new signups the day Taylor Swift's Instagram post endorsing Democrats for Congress in her new home of Tennessee and urging her 112 million followers to vote. So that's more than how many new voters were registered nationwide in the entire month of August.
So she's got 112 million followers?
On Instagram, just on Instagram.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, again, we've talked a little bit about this, mm-hmm. about celebrities and artists and entertainers. It seems to me that two things going on here. One is she's encouraging people to vote. We think that's a good thing. And I think even though, and she kind of indicated that she's going to vote for a bunch of Democrats, right?
Yes.
But I think what she did was is basically just encouraging people to vote. She's not telling them how they should vote,
right.
I don't think. She's just saying, here's how I'm voting for this reason, which right. strikes me as legitimate. You don't have to follow her, even though it's good advice that you go out to vote. Is that what's kind of going on there?
Yeah. She did kind of take a stand on where she was voting. She's obviously voting for the Democratic Party, and she said why. I think if there's an issue with this, I think the issue would be that her fans are very loyal to her. So out of that 65,000 splurge of numbers, I guess, so that group of people, if let's say 80% came from her fan base, they're going to follow whatever she follows, no matter what their actual stand on it is.
So so Fanny, that's a very good point. Okay. And let's talk about this a little bit, because I think it's very important for us in the Catholic Church, because, you know, sometimes in our history, we may have gone a little bit overboard sometimes in saints.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people accused Catholics of worshiping the saints.
Yep.
Okay. We don't worship the saints. We worship God.
Right.
We honor the saints, and particularly we honor Mary, but we don't worship them. But that doesn't mean that sometimes, maybe the way that people taught it, or maybe the way that people understood it, that it almost didn't sound a little bit like we were worshiping the saints,
right.
You know, and that's a false way of doing it. But sometimes, you know, things get a little bit tied up in that. So, and here's what I think is a little problem with sometimes celebrities, and not celebrities, but you can like music, you can like songs, you really think they're great, but if you choose to follow their politics, I think that's on you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not on the celebrity. I mean, it's, you know, and I think that's where sometimes people criticize celebrities, but they have a right to, in my judgment, they have a right to speak out. They even have a right to say, hey, I want you to vote this way. But just because I'm a fan, I might not vote that way. I mean, now, on the other hand, if Beyonce said to me, I would certainly give that a lot of weight.
Consideration, yeah.
A lot of consideration. But, you know, so anyway, so I think it's interesting. I do think it also relates to the sports issue and the issue of pointing out community violence and racism. You know, I think celebrities, they can use a platform to do it in sometimes the way that the talking heads on Sunday mornings and on those shows, they don't reach people. Now, you know, there's a little bit, you got to be cautious, and I think you got to do it responsibly, but I think it's good that we're reaching audiences that we haven't reached. So anyway, so let's take a break. This is Just Love. This is the Catholic Channel. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. So just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Just do it. Just love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
Yep, I'm here. This is Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. Our world will be more just, it will be more compassionate. You know, and speaking of compassion, some people try to figure out how you deal with compassion and how you deal with justice when it comes to the criminal justice system. And, you know, I'm one of those people who does no problem recognizing and saying, hey, there are some people who do some really bad things in the world, and we gotta make sure that we deal with that in a way that's fair and compassionate. And it doesn't mean letting people get away with things. But so I am delighted that we're going to have a conversation about where, if any place, the death penalty, capital punishment fits in to our perspective on justice and our perspective on how we deal with people who do things which are pretty, pretty bad. So I am delighted that we have as our guest Chrisanne Valancourt Murphy, who is the executive director of the Catholic Mobilizing Network. Chrisanne, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thanks, Monsignor. Good to be here.
So how, I mean, of all the things in the world that kind of could interest you, how did you become kind of interested in the death penalty?
Well, I guess I'd say twofold. When I was right out of college, I wanted to do something meaningful, and so I joined a service year program, a Christian-oriented service program that had me living and working with migrant farm workers. And while that doesn't have much to do with the death penalty, it did open up my life and my faith perspective on the world to understand that there are many people marginalized and vulnerable in our society, and that there's really important work to do to come alongside people who are marginalized and to use our voices to make change. So I would say that was the first kind of aha moment. And the second was for about 10 years, I worked with Bread for the World, an anti-hunger organization, Christian group. And in the last couple years of my tenure there, Bread for the World was looking to asking the question of how we could end hunger in the United States, and started looking at incarceration rates in the country and realizing that endemic to ending hunger in this country, we had to actually look at the incarceration epidemic and deal with what that was doing to our families and our communities and how that was impoverishing people in the United States. And so that really opened up my perspective to begin to look at the criminal justice system as an area that needed reform and really needed a lot of mercy and understanding. And I got turned on to thinking about those issues. And then early in my formative years, I saw the movie Dead Man Walking, like so many other people have, featuring the sister Helen Prejean's work in the 90s, and that never left me.
So, Chrisanne, where is, I know I've seen some of the statistics, so how many countries in the world still have the death penalty? Because I think a lot of them don't really have it, right?
Right. Well, 107 countries have abolished the death penalty. You know, no way, no using it. Another 7 have all but said, we're abolishing except for in crimes during war. So there's quite a number. And, you know, in today's day and age...
Just for the sake of it, what do we got, about 200 countries in the world?
I think it's like 180 or okay. 190. So, yeah.
So maybe about two-thirds or something have...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And then, you know, in the United States, we have bedfellows in the executing nation states like China, Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia. So that's the company that we're holding in using the death penalty.
There must be a bunch of others, though, that have the death penalty.
Yes. Yeah, but hardly ever use it.
Right.
And, yeah.
And we really don't we don't use it so much anymore, right? We're using it less and less in the United States, right?
The United States is really moving away from the practice. We are not there yet, but I think that there's this decline in public support for the death penalty. Even in the last 20 years, there's quite a marked decrease in public support for that practice. Gratefully, we are becoming much more conscious of grave harm and addressing grave harm, but through other means. And certainly with maximum security prisons, with life without parole, there are many ways of keeping society safe. So looking to the death penalty as a way of keeping society safe or dealing with crimes is becoming less and less of an option.
You know, it's interesting. Somebody, I think sometime in the past number of months, we were having a conversation here on Just Love about the death penalty. And, you know, and I think life without parole came up. And I think somebody said they'd prefer the death penalty than life without parole. That is like really that. And hasn't Pope Francis said something pretty negative about life without parole?
Indeed. Absolutely. Life without parole is really a sentence to death, but living in jail. I mean, we know that. So Pope Francis has been pretty clear about saying any form of punishment should include some hope for redemption, some possibility of redemption. And to commission someone to life in prison is really snuffing all out that hope. It doesn't mean that their life will be taken, at least through an execution chair or lethal injection, but it does relegate them to sort of that life of just lingering in death. So so that's definitely not a practice that we uphold.
So one of the things that I've been amazed by is we get this death penalty thing wrong. About, I mean, there's a lot of like people who were ultimately kind of proved innocent, go to death. It's a relatively, to me, striking number that we get it wrong on, isn't it?
It's true. For every 9 executions, there's about one person on death row who's found innocent. And the modern day era of the death penalty, which is since the Supreme Court reinstated it in 1976, there have been 163 exonerations. So you can see how many people have been found innocent, have been wrongly accused, who were sitting awaiting a death sentence date, awaiting execution. So the fact that we have gotten it wrong so many times really should cause a serious pause about using the practice.
So in the United States, is the decision whether to use it or not use it a state-by-state decision?
Absolutely. Right now it is. That is where the play is. There are 31 states that still have the death penalty. There's probably only about 10 that actually use it. For example, you know, this year there has been only 7 states that have used the practice. And of the countries who, even of the 31 that still have it on the books, there's a number of those, probably 10 or more, that have de facto moratoriums where the governor would say, not on my watch are we using the death penalty, or the DAs just are not known to be pursuing death sentences for capital crimes. So it's in some ways it's actually quite rare that the practice is being used, but in certain states like Texas, like Florida, Alabama, Arkansas, I mean, especially in that swath of the South, the practice is much more prevalent and accepted.
Well, Chrisanne, I want to thank you for what you're doing to make it less and what the Catholic Mobilizing Network is doing. Thank God it's moving in the right direction, but we kind of got to keep pushing so that it moves all the way to the end. So thanks so much for the work that you're doing, and thanks for joining us today on Just Love.
Great. Thank you.
Chrisanne Valancourt-Murphy, the executive director of the Catholic Mobilizing Network, and a couple of things stand out to me. One is we talked about how Pope Francis kind of made it even stronger, the negative opinion of our Catholic social teaching towards it, where he kind of included the word inadmissible. And previous to that, it was pretty negative. It said virtually impossible, and inadmissible was even stronger in that direction. So that's kind of an important movement. The other thing is, thank God it's moving down and there are few countries using it. But still, there are a fair number of people who are exonerated, that even though they're on death penalty, death row, they're exonerated. And that's a good thing, but it gives a little bit of a pause as to how we are doing this. So anyway, without picking sides in this, I think Taylor Swift is on the right track in encouraging people to vote. And as it's only weeks away from the midterm elections, it's a perfect opportunity for people to make sure that they register, that they actually get out and vote. And it's one of those things that is part of our Catholic social teaching. It is, civic participation. And so it's a responsibility that we have to vote, even though it can be discouraging. And maybe we kind of think all politicians aren't doing the right thing, but we have to get out there and raise our voice. So encourage you to vote. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God, your neighbor, yourself. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.